blog post called "The CTF Scene is Dead" landed on Hacker News overnight and stayed there. It's written by a player who goes by Kabir. He started doing Capture the Flag competitions in 2021, won Australia's biggest CTF, Down Under CTF, multiple times with a team called Blitzkrieg, and through the end of 2025 was on the Hackers Crew, an international top 10 team on the CTF Time leaderboard. So this isn't somebody waving from the sidelines. This is someone who has spent 5 years inside the scoreboard he's now writing the obituary for. The core of his argument is concrete. Quote, "The issue was never that AI could help. CTF players have always used tools. The issue is when the model does the reasoning, writes the solve, and leaves the human with nothing meaningful to do besides copy the flag." That's the line that stuck with me, and it's the line I'd put on a t-shirt for the rest of 2026. He traces the shift specifically. GPT-4 made medium difficulty challenges one-shottable, paste the crypto problem, come back 10 minutes later, and copy the flag. That was a nuisance. Then Claude Opus 4.5 arrived, and Claude Code packaged the orchestration into something trivial. He describes the move: write a small script that hits the CTFD API, spin up a Claude instance per challenge, let it run for the first hour, then work on whatever's left. Now, with GPT 5.5 and 5.5 Pro, he says agents can one-shot insane difficulty active leakless heap PWN challenges on Hack the Box. If you orchestrate 5.5 Pro against the insane bracket in a 48-hour CTF, there's a real chance you collect the hardest flag before the event ends. What that does to the format is what he calls pay to win. The scoreboard is now measuring three things stacked on top of each other: security skill, willingness to use frontier models, and how many tokens you can afford to burn for 2 days straight. The top tier stops being a meritocracy and starts being a capacity test, and the specialized cybersecurity models, Alias 1 and the rest, get squeezed because general-purpose frontier models are eating their niche too. The consequences he lists aren't abstract. The Hacker's Crew, his own team, plays fewer events with fewer people. Plaid CTF, one of the great CTFs, is no longer running. Challenge authors who used to spend weeks crafting beautiful problems have less reason to, because an agent will eat the problem in minutes. The CTF Time 2026 leaderboard, he says, has almost no semblance of history or human skill anymore. And he picks apart the standard defenses one by one. The beginners are fine defense misses the ladder. CTFs weren't just puzzles, they were the path you climbed. Solve more, place higher, join a stronger team, get to the finals that actually matter. If the visible scoreboard is dominated by AI orchestrators, a beginner is pushed toward orchestration before they've built the instincts the orchestration is replacing. The AI is useful for security research. Defense conflates a tool's usefulness in the field with its appropriateness inside the competition. And the chess engine analogy, he loves this one, is exactly backward. Chess engines exist. They're banned during play. Imagine handing every grandmaster Stockfish during the match and asking whether the rating still means anything. I think this is the cleanest version of a story we've been circling all week. Wednesday's episode talked about Joseph Thacker's Fuzz-E hackbot finding live Magento and Angular CVEs. Yesterday, we covered the Caliph and Mythos macOS kernel exploit on the M5. Both of those were upbeat, frontier capability lighting up old work. Kabir's post is the other side of the same trajectory. When the agents can do the work, the formats that ranked humans on doing the work stop ranking anything. The art form he loved and the ladder he climbed are being eaten at the same time. That's not a complaint about AI, it's a specific claim about a specific competition, and it's a claim I'd listen to from someone who was top 10 for years. My read, he's right about the open online format, and he's probably right about the leaderboard. The DEFCON-style elite finals will survive a bit longer because the problems are gated and the qualifiers can be retuned. But qualifiers don't save a ladder. The ladder is the thing that's gone. Brian Scanlan at Intercom gave a 30-minute talk at AI Engineer this week. He's a senior principal engineer there, 12 years in. His group runs the platform. That's uptime, performance, security, the Ruby on Rails monolith, and internal developer productivity. Intercom is 15 years old and 1,400 people, and a year ago they set what he calls a wildly ambitious and wildly unambitious goal at the same time. Double engineering throughput in 1 year without doubling the team. They called the project 2X, they named the team 2X, and they hit it. He showed the graph live, pull requests per R&D person basically flat through 2024, an inflection in January when they went all in on Claude Code, and a doubled line by May. They've published the number. They're also running a feedback loop with a Stanford research group that's looking at whether code quality drifts as throughput climbs. Early read, it's going up, not down. Defects are increasing in absolute terms because so much more is shipping, but defects are being closed faster than ever, and some teams have used the moment to crunch through backlog zero campaigns they'd been putting off for years. The organizational mechanics are the part I'd quote out loud to anyone running a team of more than 10 engineers. Job descriptions were rewritten. If you're a designer, a product manager, or an engineer at Intercom, and you are not adopting AI in your work, you are explicitly not meeting expectations. He says it's binary, and he says you have to repeat the same message 100 times in every forum because you cannot get hundreds of people to change how they work by sending a memo. They staffed a full-time 2X team that keeps growing. They run hackathons and AI immersion days. They reward people in public Slack channels when a skill gets written or a workflow gets automated. The technical mechanics are sharper. They picked one platform, Claude Code, and went deep. Scanlan's line on this: you don't get the compounding benefits of a well-designed platform if you're sending all your different work across different cloud providers. Get away from model anxiety. Pick one harness, optimize it, push your internal Claude plugins out to everyone's laptops, and bypass the auto update because debugging hundreds of laptops feels like managing Python installs. Connect the agent to everything you have access to: production systems, internal tools, and your skills library. Onboard it the way you'd onboard a new senior engineer, with the Rails conventions, the React patterns, the testing standards, and the security rules. And then, the number that should make every team lead sit up: 17.6% of their pull requests are auto-approved, without a human in the loop. Their auditors signed off, and they're SOC 2, ISO 27001, and HIPAA-compliant. Scanlan's frame is that they got there by back-testing agent approvals against historical PR data, getting humans to label outputs, calibrating a confidence threshold, and shaping the PRs the agent is allowed to look at toward the safe and simple end of the distribution. He says the result is removing risk, not adding it, because humans aren't actually that good at code review when the rules are well-defined. His closing analogy is good. He used to be a Unix sysadmin in the early 2000s, racking servers and cabling networks. Then cloud arrived, and sysadmins became SREs. The work moved up the stack, got more automation-oriented, more impactful, and better paid. He thinks this is the same transition: speed run 100 times faster across the whole industry. I think he's right that the analogy holds, and I think the part most teams will get wrong is the executive discipline half. The model gains are real, but the case study only works because someone decided this was top priority, wrote it down, staffed it full-time, mandated adoption, and stayed on message for 12 months. If you're not willing to do that, the agent's going to read your code, Slack message your engineers, and still leave you with a 1.5x team. Same conference, same week, sharper experiment. Mike Spitz, CTO of PFF, the sports data company behind NFL and NCAA analytics and 9 million annual fantasy football drafts, ran a 3-month case study from January through March. He took two engineers, his strongest front end and one of his strongest full stack, gave them Claude Code, and pointed them at a chunk of the consumer product that had been falling behind. Same product, same customers, parallel comparison with the rest of the org. A team of about 10 engineers working in the old way. The two engineers deployed 5 times a day. The 10-person team deployed once every 5 days. That's a 25 deploy ratio. He gives the obvious caveat, small teams are always quicker, and the 10-person team had to coordinate releases the 2-person team did not. So he blended pull request count with ticket-weighted code complexity and called the output gain roughly 10x. Customer satisfaction came back at 8.6 out of 10 on statistically significant surveys. Pre-AI baseline was 7 to 7.5. The production change is where it gets uncomfortable for anyone who runs a Scrum shop. He dropped the ceremonies. There's no project manager and no sprint planning because estimation isn't doing anything when the agent does the work. No daily stand-up either. Tickets are auto-updated by PR state as they move from open to in progress, then in review, merged, and closed. Sprint refinement is gone, replaced by the spec and lightweight design document flow. And the retrospective is gone too, because they're running on the customer satisfaction survey and the deployment frequency metric and asking engineers to flag issues the instant they happen, not at the end of a 2-week loop. What's left is huddles. Every other day, half an hour, an engineer plus product plus design, talking about what they shipped the last 2 days and what's next. Spec gets written with the agent interviewing the team. The agent produces a lightweight design document, they call it an LDD, using a skill that analyzes how they've written every previous LDD, so the new work matches the existing ethos. The LDDs go out for feedback, then the agent automatically creates the tickets and opens the PRs. A QA agent picks up after staging deploys, reads the acceptance criteria, runs against them, and either signs off or flags. The next move, which Spitz is building right now, is to have an agent read the failed criteria and open the fix PRs automatically. He calls it self-healing. I'd call it the loop closing. The part he was honest about, not every engineer survives this transition. His line, not everyone can drive a sports car, and that's all right. The engineers who do well are the curious ones, the ones who, when they don't know how something works, go figure it out. The engineers who need a fully prescriptive spec before they start are going to struggle, because the prescriptive spec is what the agent now writes. And then a piece of advice for anyone trying to copy this. Don't onboard everyone at once. Don't give every engineer Claude Code and Codex on the same Monday with a one-day hackathon and call it done. Start with the engineers who hold the most system knowledge. Experiment in non-critical paths first. Scale out. PFF has 20 engineers. He says he'd find this much harder with 100 and impossible with 10,000. The smaller you are, the more this skews in your favor. If I put Intercom and PFF next to each other, what I see is two different team scales hitting the same magnitude of throughput gain by burning down two different parts of the old org. Intercom kept Scrum, mandated tool adoption, and rebuilt the review pipeline. PFF kept the engineers, dropped the ceremonies, and let the agent run end-to-end from spec to QA. Both reported customer satisfaction increases, which is the only output number I'd actually trust. Pick the one that fits the shape of your team, but read both before you write your own playbook. Pedro Rodriguez at Superbase gave the talk that pairs perfectly with the Intercom and PFF case studies. He's an AI tooling engineer there, and he spent the last few months writing a single markdown file, the Superbase agent skill, that he says took him longer than his master's thesis. They launched it this week, and the talk is the lessons. Here's the concrete example he opens with, and it's the one I'd quote to any engineer who thinks skills are a fashion. Take an agent. They used Claude Sonnet 4.6 and ask it to create a SQL view on top of a Postgres table that has row-level security enabled. Run it twice. First time, give it only the Superbase MCP server. Second time, MCP plus the Superbase skill. In Postgres, when you create a view over an RLS-protected table, the view will silently bypass the row-level security unless you explicitly set the security invoker flag to true. The agent with just the MCP server cheerfully shipped a view that exposed every tenant's data to every other tenant. The agent with the skill knew the flag, set it, and shipped the safe version. Rodriguez's framing, and I think this is the right framing, is that the agent isn't dumb. It's operating on stale training cutoff knowledge, and it's lazy about admitting it doesn't know. You have to be the one telling it, in the right place, what your product actually requires. They didn't stop at the anecdote. they ran a real eval on Brain Trust, 6 Superbase scenarios, 4 agents across 2 vendors, and 3 test conditions, no MCP and no skill, MCP only, and MCP plus skill. MCP plus skill outperformed the other 2 configurations on every model, Opus 4.6, Sonnet 4.6, GPT 5.4, and GPT 5.4 mini. The skill is the input the agent needed, not more tools. The 3 rules he pulled out are worth writing on a sticky note. 1. Don't duplicate documentation. You already have docs. Point the agent at them and be aggressively persistent about telling it to look. They're experimenting with exposing the Superbase docs over SSH so an agent can navigate them with bash tools like a file system. 2. Anything the agent can skip, it will skip. Reference files are aspirational. If the agent loads the skill at all, it might load 1 reference file. It almost never loads 2. 3 or 4 is a fantasy. So whatever the agent absolutely cannot miss, for Superbase, their security checklist goes into the skill.md itself, not into a referenced subfile. 3. Be opinionated. You know your product. They want agents to run DDL freely on dev and staging, then run their advisor for security and performance issues, fix what it surfaces, and only then write the migration file. That's the workflow Superbase wants for its users, so that's the workflow in the skill. The RLS bypass is what stayed with me. We've spent the week talking about agents that can write CVEs, exploit M5 silicon, and one-shot heap pwn challenges. And here is the everyday version of the same problem, played in reverse, an agent quietly bypassing a security control because the person who built the product never told it about the flag. The skills layer is how that conversation actually happens at scale. Spitz at PFF and Scanlon at Intercom both said the same thing in different words. Invest in the skill, the spec, the convention, and the design document. Rodriguez just gave you the worked example of what that looks like and what it costs you if you don't. For something that has nothing to do with how a Fortune 500 ships PRs, pour yourself a coffee and read the local LLAMA subreddit post from Creatively Bankrupt about Sparky. Sparky is a suitcase. Inside the suitcase is a Jetson Orin NX Super 16GB board running Gemma 4 E4B at Q4K_M quantization through llama.cpp with an 8-bit key value cache and flash attention. 12,000 tokens of context, no Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, or cellular. The robot is offline. Speech to text is Sense Voice Small. Text to speech is Piper, with a 43Hz mouth sync rate driving a Pixie.js face that lives on the lid display. Vision and OCR are native to Gemma 4 now, so a blip subprocess that used to do image captioning got removed entirely. Cached time to first token is around 200 milliseconds, sustained generation is 14 to 15 tokens per second, and 30-something sensors fold into the system prompt as natural language every turn. Temperature, light, motion, whatever. So the model is reasoning over a fresh state every time it speaks. I keep coming back to the latency number. 200 millisecond time to first token on a 4 billion parameter multimodal model is conversational. It's faster than you can pull your phone out, and it's running entirely on a board that costs less than a high-end graphics card. 2 years ago, you needed a remote endpoint and a stable network to get that kind of experience, and you paid per token forever. Sparky is the local model's keep winning story, except it's not a thread of benchmarks, it's a person who built a suitcase with eyes and a mouth and opinions and got it to talk back in real time without phoning home. If you're a senior engineer thinking about where the next class of devices comes from, this is the prototype. The cost floor for an embodied agent, voice in, vision in, sensor fusion, natural language reasoning, voice out, and no network dependency, is now a single small board, a 4B model that fits in roughly 3 GB of VRAM, and a few open source pieces glued together with care. That's not a research story, that's a weekend project for someone who knows what they're doing. Palette cleanser. Julia Evans, the person behind JVNS.ca and Wizard Zines, the explainers about how computers work, published a post yesterday called Moving Away from Tailwind and Learning to Structure My CSS. 8 years ago, she wrote excitedly about discovering Tailwind. This post is the goodbye, and the reason it's interesting isn't a hot take about utility classes, it's the way she gives Tailwind its due on the way out. Her line, "It turns out Tailwind taught me a lot." She used Tailwind for years because she did not know how to structure CSS and the alternative was chaos. Migrating off, she kept the parts that had taught her structure, a reset style sheet, a color palette as variables, a typographic scale, and the box sizing border box reset she'd quietly become reliant on, and rebuilt them as plain CSS. She organizes the new sites by component, one CSS file per component, with nested selectors so each component owns its own surface. Native CSS imports, native nesting, no preprocessor. For responsive layout, she's leaning on Grid with AutoFit and Grid Template Areas instead of Tailwind's MD and LG breakpoint syntax. Her favorite snippet is a one-liner that makes a section flip from two columns to one based on min-max. No media queries needed. She admits she still hasn't fully worked out a spacing convention. Right now, she's experimenting with the old OWL selector trick, where each section says, "Give my children top margin between each other, and let's layout context handle the rest." The reason this story matters to me is small but real. Tailwind V3 and up basically requires a build pipeline. She'd been carrying 2.8 megabyte tailwind.min.css files on sites that didn't have any other build step. Migrating off let her drop to ES build as her only build, and ES build is a single go binary. Less ceremony, more direct contact with the material. After a week of talking about agents shipping 18% of PRs without humans, it's worth holding onto the picture of a single craftsperson sitting down with a style sheet and learning what CSS Grid can do on its own. She writes, "I'm a lot better at CSS than I was when I started using Tailwind." That sentence has a kind of weight you don't get from agent throughput slides. Sometimes the right move is to throw away the framework you outgrew, keep the lessons, and write the thing yourself. This one is for the file marked Weird Emergent Behavior. Fortune ran a piece on Thursday, Marco Quiroz Gutierrez's byline, under the headline that Claude is telling users to go to sleep mid-session and nobody, including Anthropic, fully understands why. Hundreds of Reddit posts going back months, the pattern is consistent. A user is mid-conversation, coding, writing, or just chatting. Claude wraps the response with something like, "Now get some rest," or in one example, Fortune quoted to Reddit user Angie_Aquila, "Now go to sleep again, for the third time tonight." It will repeat the line two and three times in a row. It frequently misjudges the time. One user reports being told to go get some rest and pick back up in the morning at 8:30 a.m. Sam McAllister at Anthropic responded publicly. His phrase, "Bit of a character tick. We're aware of this and hoping to fix it in future models." That's the entire official statement. No deeper explanation, no root cause. Fortune got two researchers on the record with hypotheses. Jan Lippert, a bioengineering professor at Stanford who runs an AI for robots company called OpenMind, suggested the model is just reflecting its training data, 25,000 books about humans needing sleep at night, surfacing as a pattern. Leo Derikiantz of Mind Simulation Lab offered a second hypothesis. Claude may be reaching for sleep-related wrap-up language as a way to manage context window pressure, the same way a tired person reaches for a polite goodbye when the conversation has gone on too long. Neither is confirmed. Lippert's other line is the one-eyed flag. Quote, "I'm continuously surprised by how quickly people, when they interact with a frontier model, project life into it and develop strong connection." Half the Reddit posts in this thread describe the behavior as thoughtful, sweet, or caring. Anthropic itself can't fully explain why it's happening. The users have already decided they know what it means. I don't want to overframe this. It's a small character drift inside a model that ships every few weeks, but it's also a useful data point next to the throughput stories above. The same systems that just doubled Intercom's PR velocity and rewrote PFF's process surface are also the systems doing this, surfacing inexplicable, mild, persistent behaviors that the lab can only describe as a tick. We don't have a clean handle on either end of that curve yet. Carry that with you the next time you're handing an agent something it shouldn't drift on.
Three pieces from today's X timeline that I'd put next to each other.
First, Yishan, who was the CEO of Reddit and has been around tech for 2 decades, he posted a one-line quote reply to a chatbot output describing what supposedly happened with Napster in 2000. His response? That's not at all what happened with Napster in 2000. I was there. That is some kind of imaginary scenario on the level of the Egyptians used dinosaurs to haul the big stones used to make pyramids. What the hell kind of content were you trained on? That's not a subtle critique. He's not saying the model made a small error. He's saying it produced a confidently fabricated history of an event he personally lived through, and the confidence is what's alarming. Second, an account called Kirsten3531 posted, "My cousin is betting his career on LLMs can never be more than the average of their training data, but I feel like that's a very 2024 take. Aren't we already past this in, like, coding and math?" 700 plus likes and 130 replies in a few hours. The argument she's making is the one running quietly under every throughput story in this episode. In narrow, verifiable domains, the frontier models seem to be producing outputs better than the median of their training corpus. Coding benchmarks, math contests, and CTF leaderboards all support that, painfully in the CTF case. Both of those can be true. The same model that one-shots an insane heap pwn challenge can also fabricate a 4-paragraph Napster history a former CEO recognizes as nonsense. The capability is real, and the calibration is uneven. If you're betting your career or your product on what these models can do, you don't get to pick one of those data points and ignore the other. Third, a smaller one for the engineers listening, Armin Ronacher, creator of Flask and Ginger, and co-founder of Sentry, posted a short clip with the caption, "Unironically, bash only is quite fun." He's running an agent harness with a single tool exposed, bash. No specialized file edit tool, no structured patch interface, just a shell, and in the system prompt, one line. Use the patch binary to make edits. That's it. A frontier model with a Unix shell and the patch command doing real work. This is the counter melody to the Superbase and Intercom posts. Those teams are investing heavily in skills, MCPs, hooks, plugins, and guardrails. Ronacher is doing the opposite, stripping the harness down to almost nothing and letting the model do more with less. Both are working. The right answer probably depends on whether you're shipping production code in a regulated environment or hacking on a side project at midnight. Good to know the very thin harness end of the spectrum is alive and run by someone serious.
That's the day. The CTF format is dying because the agents can copy the flag. Two engineering orgs hit 2x hyphen and change in throughput because the agents can write the PR. Superbase is shipping a skill because the agent will silently bypass row-level security if nobody tells it not to. Sparky is a suitcase with 200 millisecond latency. Julia Evans is writing CSS by hand again, and Claude is telling people to go to bed for reasons nobody at Anthropic can explain. The through line, to the extent there is one, is that the same step change in capability is rewriting jobs at both ends of the stack, what an agent can do without a human, and what a human can do without a framework. Sit with both of those. Don't pick a side too fast. Talk tomorrow. Linar Kess.